Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
My thanks to the Piccolo Lasso Choir. We're going to have another song from them after I introduce you to our business reviewers of the week and indeed the weekend. Stephen O'Leary from Politico is with us, as is Joan Mulville, digitalisation lead at Siemens. That's a breathtaking way to start a business show. What did you think of the business choir?
Oh, they're fantastic. They're really brilliant.
Yeah, very hard to follow, but really, really great to hear.
All right, I'll bring you back to matters more mundane, Stephen. Martin, to be Taoiseach first, says Simon Harris, and that's the lead-in from today's Irish Times.
Yeah, look, this is news that surprises no one, really. You know, yeah. As soon as we got kind of the final vote counts through, it was kind of clear that this was the order it was going to happen. And if there was going to be an order, there was speculation that perhaps we'd have a single Taoiseach. But I think there's a lot of jostling going on. And in fact, you know, Jack Power, Jennifer Bray and Pat Lee here are writing today, and this is all about jostling. Yeah. Right, it's everyone kind of putting their best foot forward in terms of what they want. So obviously the Taoiseach's position is what's the lead here, but there's lots more in terms of the bargaining going on, in terms of the independence and the role they'll play, amongst others. So it's the classic government formation negotiation.
And you've got the Healy Rays sort of on the edge, you know, ready to participate if there's enough in it for them, but equally probably ready to walk away if they need to do that.
That was the parting shot in the story that I found rather amusing. It's Mr. Healy Ray said, instead of a three-legged stool, the next generation could be a four-legged chair, suggesting that there could be two separate groups of independents, the Healy Rays being a whole group by themselves.
Yeah. Separately, though, Joan, we read in the Irish Examiner from Elaine Loughlin that Micheál Martin maybe needs to just be a little bit careful about some dissenters in the ranks. The Ceann Comhairle vote, there were 20 out of the 48 that voted against the government, although it's a secret ballot.
Yeah.
That's the figure being reported. So that does sort of detect some notes of dissension within the ranks.
Yeah, it is a little bit. I mean, the Ceann Comhairle piece has been going on now since the election results were known, and it was always going to be somewhat contentious, but I think... yeah, but if you look at geographically where some of it's coming from, and you know, Malcolm Byrne is quoted here, obviously he's in the same constituency, and maybe it doesn't work as well for him to see Verona get such a prominent position. But they did hark back to when Micheál Martin was somewhat under threat a couple of years ago from a bit of a potential heave, and that nothing is to be taken for granted. But with that said, you know, he's delivered a great result for Fianna Fáil in this election and for his own party. And he's
also a bit of a veteran around.
This is it. It's this voice of maturity that you've got now. And I think from that versus, you know, where Fine Gael are at, where they lost, you know, 19 resignations, not seats, but actually resignations going into this general election. That need for maturity and experience is probably coming to the fore. So I suspect he should be safe for a while, depending on how the negotiations of the next week or so goes. But yeah, it's an interesting angle.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. As Stephen said, lots more to, I think, unfurl as the flag happens as we run up to the new year. Indeed, the rate of mortgage arrears, this is a good news story, falling to its lowest in 15 years. The proportion of mortgages at least 3 months in arrears has fallen to its lowest level since the depths of the financial crisis 15 years ago. It pleases me to read this, Stephen.
Yeah, it's a great news story. This is Peter Flanagan writing in the Irish Times today. And, you know, it really is an incredible headline to think that this is the lowest rate since 2009. And it's the trajectory too, right, that this is going in a direction and that this isn't just a point in time. But the hope would be that this rate can get even lower. That's certainly when and what comes through. And I think what's interesting is that the analysis shows the difference between what the arrears look like for mortgages on family homes. So they look at family homes that are in long-term arrears. So that's at least 1 year behind in payments. And that stands now at a little under 20,000 at the end of September. But that's just 2.8% of all principal dwelling house mortgages in the country, down more than 1,200 on the same time last year. So like that is 1,200 from a baseline of 20,000 is an incredible drop to see. And the hope would be that that's a trajectory that will continue.
Joan, one of the standout figures for me separate to that was that first time buyers are now typically paying 88 grand more for a house now than they did 5 years ago. That jumps off the page at you.
It does, and particularly in light of all of this story, to be considered in light of the fact that interest rates have been very high, gradually crept up over the last number of years. So to be paying that much more at a higher interest rate, to have fewer in arrears as well at the same time as that, that's an interesting almost contradictory confluence of events. The number of first-time buyers, but also, and I was delighted that they quoted it. I was reading through it and I'm going, where is this bit? And there it was. The ESRI warned earlier this week that house prices are actually inflated at the moment over 10% of what they're worth. And I think that's interesting, that 88,000 more that they're paying, and that there is a slight, I don't know, inflation in house prices beyond what you'd expect or in terms of being overvalued. So that's a little bit worrying. But as I say, to Stephen's point, I mean, it is generally a very, very good news story. And I think the only thing that I thought was a little bit sad in it, and for me, it was just that the number of this, and it's a small number of them, but almost one in four of those having been in the legal process for over 5 years, the human toll of that is phenomenal. And so if you are one of those people, that is incredibly difficult. So for the general economy, it's a good news story. But for those people, that is
absolutely
a long and painful process.
Stephen, just trying to interpret these sort of figures coming through from Board or from Fáilte Ireland. Visitors numbers below expectations. The Examiner is telling us a bit more clearly that the tourism sector has its own storm warnings. So there's a few problems going on here. There's a lack of suitable accommodation for tourists, which is one thing, which is showing some sort of buoyancy in some parts of the tourism. But the figures overall are down.
They are. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different sources of data that are coming together here for this analysis and this reporting. And again, there's a little bit to unpick. But on that point about the availability of accommodation, what's really interesting here is that there's a quote in the piece that says the level of Fáilte Ireland registered bed stock under government contract has actually fallen to 10% from 12% in November, and more was expected to come out of contract over the summer. So actually there's an expectation that more of this accommodation is going to become available. And the piece also cites that actually in Dublin in particular, that there is a lot of new hotel stock about to come on stream. So look, there's no doubting the year feels flat in terms of the reporting. One in four Irish tourism businesses saw growth year on year in terms of customer numbers. So it's not, this in contrast is not a good news story. But certainly this increase in availability of accommodation that seems to be cited for 2025 probably gives those in the broader tourism economy a little bit of cause for optimism.
Well, it looks like we're down 400 odd thousand foreign visitors. That's about 9% on last year in totality. So like that is a, that's a meaty enough figure that we'd want to be concerned about.
It is. And I think, too, it doesn't say specifically where they're down from, if you know what I mean. Is it the US? Is it the UK? Is it Europe? But I think as a year looking back, you know, I think a lot of people might have been financially uncertain. And they said these are people who are looking for value. It's been a challenging year. We've had a lot of elections going on. And I think a lot of people might have been biding their time on retirement or taking that big trip. So you never know. Maybe next year we'll see things level back out a little bit.
This is a marketing story we're moving to next, or is it? Guinness shortage has lessons for Diageo on the merits of longevity. A great piece in the Irish Times. But again, you know, you'd have to ask, are Guinness masters of the message? Are they creating insatiable demand for their product by saying it isn't available or enough of it isn't available in the UK? Stephen.
Yeah, so this is where the word shortage is doing an awful lot of heavy lifting, Bobby, as a term. I don't think anyone in Diageo or Guinness is going to be upset about what they're hearing here. So this relates to the availability of Guinness, particularly in the UK market. We've been promised that we won't run out in Ireland. But also the reality is, how much are they really going to run out of this within the UK market? There's no doubting that the popularity of Guinness is surging, particularly in the UK market at the moment. And I think it's not a huge leap to say that their title sponsorship of the Premier League could see a direct correlation between that. We often talk about the importance of these title sponsorships, and we're really kind of
one in nine pints now consumed in Britain is Guinness.
Yeah, and like, I mean,
I think that's a telling stat.
It's an incredible statistic. And we know, particularly from social, things like this term, like splitting the G amongst others, there's a real social cachet to drinking Guinness at the moment. And it's not just what you're consuming, but it's the images you put up on Instagram and all that goes with it.
I think that's the interesting part. I was at a gig last week. Kishibashi was over from the States, and they were passing up pints of Guinness onto the stage, and it was all about split the G. But one of the things this article references is the emotion and identity attached to the heritage value of the brand of Guinness. And I thought instantly of where Jaguar Land Rover have just been through their rebranding and the huge backlash they got for rejecting a lot of their heritage. And you can see the smarts in Guinness here that they are saying, right, okay, all this, you know, craft beers and IPAs, all of that. And then you're looking at this heritage brand that is very location sensitive. And I thought it was interesting that it follows the Fáilte Ireland story. Maybe this will drive our tourism numbers back up. The only place you can be guaranteed to get a Guinness where we will never run out is here.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll move on to Dublin Airport because, again, it's a busy spot at this time of the year. There's lots going out there. Michael O'Leary, again, having a pop at the government, letting out warnings. But Dublin Airport have officially now seeked the immediate passenger cap increase from 32 to 36 million, and the case is heading to Europe. It seems almost odd that this could be going on as long as it's going on. And it also seems that no one is really in control of what's happening here.
Yes, and it probably points to a broader planning issue that Ireland has, right? The airport is not unique in this situation, and the length of time it takes to get through certain planning processes. But this has a massive knock-on effect. Yeah. Right, this is the main gateway for the world to Ireland.
We're an island nation.
And we rely, you know, we obviously have airports in other parts of the country that are all, you know, extremely important and play a vital role in that tourism and travel sector as well. But Dublin is our biggest. It gets you into the capital city. It is crucial for business and tourism and a range of other things. And to an extent, this is an element of compromise, right? Although the 36 million figure was flagged earlier this year and we knew that this was the number that was going to be there, it's down from the 40 million that's ultimately going to be needed. So the thing I would take a little bit of comfort from if I was the DA at the moment is that the two main parties in the next government in both their manifestos committed to abolishing the cap.
Yeah.
And I would be repeatedly coming back to that when I'm talking about this.
And O'Leary is smart enough to play his sound bites just as the negotiations are happening, and he's going to be driving that home too.
Yeah, he is, and I'm going to be driving home to Mullingar later on, so I'm not going to disagree with him either. But I think what's worth bearing in mind is that cap was set in 2007. It is 2024. You know, the world has moved on. The economy is a different place. We can't afford to be having a cap, and we can't afford to have prices of flights as they are right now. It is very expensive again to get in and out of London, for example, just on a business trip, practically speaking, you know, and we do want to maintain ourselves almost not only as a gateway into Ireland, but also for a lot of people from a tourism point of view. Again, it's a lovely starting point for a lot of people doing their trips to Europe. So we need to make Ireland and Dublin in particular as accessible as possible.
Stephen, we talked about the Guinness and its marketing prowess. Another piece that, and I think we should give some note to this, is the booze-free beer market is very underdeveloped here. A piece picked up by Cantillon in today's Irish Times. Some of the figures in here are quite astonishing.
They are, and of all the stories we're reviewing today, this is the one that surprised me the most. Certainly anecdotally, when on the rare occasions I am out and I see what people are consuming in pubs and bars, there seems to be a marked increase in the amount of alcohol-free beer and alcohol-free products more broadly that are being consumed. But here it accounts for a tiny percentage, so 2% of
the overall beer market.
Yeah, so they contrast, to give that percentage context, in Spain it accounts for over 14%.
Yeah, and I think what's common in Spain that may not be common here is somebody having a 0.0 beer with their lunch, for instance, which people may do here, but it would be infrequent, I'd suggest, at best.
I think it's the optics too. Like, it's no longer optically acceptable to be seen drinking in the middle of the day. In that, you know, you're out for lunch, you'd have, there's no alcohol in a you know, a Moretti or a Peroni Zero or whatever. And I would happily drink one instead of a glass of sparkling water or Coke. But I just think it would look really odd. And I just think that's a kind of a cultural difference. And it is a taste thing as well. I think it's very accessible to get big main brands like a Heineken Zero and Guinness now as well. But for more, for lighter beers, like for me personally, I'd love to be able to go out and get a Peroni Zero as quickly in a bar as I can buy it in a supermarket.
Well, it just shows that, because I remember back to the awful days of things like Caliber that were basically undrinkable. that at least now we have a range of products, pick whatever brand you want, but they're all pretty good. So like the technology or whatever they've done to align, I suppose, the 0.0 with the alcohol drink, they taste almost the same.
Yeah, and you would imagine that there has to be some level of correlation between those record-breaking Guinness numbers that we heard earlier and the rise in the popularity of their 0.0 product.
Yeah. Talk to me about this town in Copenhagen, Nordhaven, the 5-minute city inside Denmark's revolutionary neighbourhood. We've heard a lot about the 15-minute city being a reality. A lot of sort of criticism around, you know, it displacing people and is it really the way we want to live? It's a long article, Joan. What did you make of it?
It's a long article, but it's a beautiful story, actually. They've made it very, very successful.
Maybe tell our listeners.
Yes. So it is this town in outside Copenhagen where they've basically made the... We've talked about 15-minute city. This is about 5 minutes. It's about people coming together and the quality of life. And it seems to be considered from all aspects of social engagement to work to multipurpose buildings and just really making it... In a way, it's almost like fairy tale like town of just everyone just peacefully wandering around, getting a coffee and a Danish in the morning. It's total Highgate joy. And occasionally an electric car will glide by as if, you know, carried on the wings of angels. So it's a really cool way of looking at city planning. And in fact, interestingly, just by coincidence, I met an old school friend last night, Helen Farrell, and her son is 19 and he's studying urban planning in Amsterdam. He said there's only one place to do it in Ireland and it's in UCD, but he said the Dutch are so far ahead in terms of urban planning. And I was so hopeful that this next generation of young people who are coming forward, who are looking at how we can make our cities better and much more functional and usable. But also what is good about this is not a greenfield site town. This is brownfield. They have repurposed existing buildings and that's what's really interesting.
And what's also interesting, Stephen, is it not, is that the car was the last thing to be included. So it was, how do we live? How do we shop? How do we do our business? And then we include the car. Is that the real difference here?
It absolutely is. Well, the idea is you don't need a car.
Yeah.
This town is designed without one. So two quick things on this. Buy a paper. This is an excellent long read by the Irish Examiner today, if you're listening, and read this article in full. There's so much to kind of take in. And the second is, this is not some sort of foreign utopia. We could do this in Dublin. This is absolutely achievable within not just Dublin, right across the country. But there are so many parts of Dublin that if we looked at density in a different way, this could happen here.
Yeah.
And I think you could do it in smaller sites. I mean, I'm looking at Mullingar and it is just a lovely, it's for me, it's this like perfect Goldilocks size of town, but it's how we make it so much more accessible. And there's a lot of housing going up there now at the moment, but you need to say, well, actually, how is that functioning? That it's not just houses and building the services and amenities around all of that.
Well, look, I'd like to thank both my guests, regular paper reviewers and business story reviewers that you are, Joan Mulville and Stephen O'Leary. Thank you for joining us, as always. And thank you for being part of this special Down to Business show.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.